Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Please take your seats. My name is Rima Rosen. I'm the Interim Vice Principal, Research and International Relations. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the Beattie Memorial Lecture for McGill Homecoming Weekend 2010. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à la conférence commémorative Beattie, un événement annuel très cher à l'Université McGill. The Beattie Memorial Lecture dates back to 1952 when the university received a $100,000 gift from Dr. Henry Beattie to hold a public lecture series in honor of his brother, Sir Edward Beattie. Sir Edward Beattie was president of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and he also served McGill as chancellor and chair of the Board of Governors for over two decades, from 1920 to 1943. The Beattie family has had a lasting impact at McGill. In addition to student scholarships in the name of Sir Beattie, Beattie Hall is the current home of the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. The Beattie Memorial Lecture Series was created to bring top thinkers, innovators, and leaders to the university, to advance scholarship, and to inform the broader community. Topics over the last few years have included AIDS, politics, Plato, physics, evolution, atmospheric change, urbanization, comedy, and technology. Aujourd'hui, nous avons l'honneur d'accueillir parmi nous le Dr. Muhammad Yunus, lauréat de nombreux prix, dont le prix Nobel de la paix à 2006. Today, we continue to honor the Beattie legacy and the altruistic goals of the generous endowment, as we welcome Nobel laureate Dr. Muhammad Yunus to lecture on social business, a revolutionary concept for the 21st century. I would like to thank the Des Hôtels Faculty of Management and the McGill World Platform for Health and Economic Convergence for inviting Dr. Yunus to join us at McGill. Dr. Yunus is honorary chair of the McGill World Platform, an interdisciplinary initiative of the Des Hôtels Faculty of Management and the Faculty of Medicine. The platform was established by Des Hôtels Professor Laurette Dubé to help bridge the traditional divide between market, economy, and society, a divide which has created significant challenges to sustainable economic health and to human health and well-being. The McGill World Platform is a prime example of McGill's dedication to interdisciplinary, innovative, and collaborative research and to seeking solutions for global challenges. I now call upon Chancellor Arnold Steinberg to introduce our esteemed guest.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Bonjour à tous. Thank you, Vice Principal Rosen. Let me add my welcome to all of you this morning, to the Beattie Lecture, and to Homecoming and Parents Weekend 2010. The Beattie Memorial Lecture, as Rima has indicated, is among the university's most prestigious annual events. Certainly, it is a keystone of this weekend of connecting with and celebrating McGill. It is also an event by which we measure the continuing greatness of our university. Some of the world's best minds come together here, and the work they do drives global change in medicine, industry, business, science, and the arts. It is a reflection of the privilege we enjoy as a first-class institution that we're able to welcome a speaker of such singular distinction as this year's Beattie Memorial Lecturer, Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus. Known around the world as the banker to the poor, Professor Yunus was born in Chittagong in what is now Bangladesh. By the age of 22, he was lecturing in economics at Chittagong College, and at 25, he was awarded a Fulbright Fellowship to study in the United States, where he earned his doctorate at Vanderbilt University. He returned to Bangladesh in 1972 to head the Department of Economics at the recently established Chittagong University. He took on the role of director of the university's Rural Economics Program, and it was there he conceived the seemingly heretical concept of extending credit to the country's poorest citizens. The program's objectives were to end the exploitation of the poor by moneylenders, to create opportunities for self-employment in rural Bangladesh, and to promote a means of financing that the most disadvantaged people, primarily women in extreme poverty, could manage themselves. The result was the Grameen Bank, formally created through government legislation in 1983. Under Professor Yunus's direction, the bank offered small amounts of money to those who would never qualify for loans from traditional banks, allowing them to fund grassroots business initiatives. The success of the Grameen Bank and the concept of microcredit have changed the way we think about poverty and about the ability and willingness of the poor to help themselves. It is estimated that the advent of microcredit has helped lift as many as 100 million people out of despair of harsh poverty. As a result of this transformative contribution to world economic development, Professor Yunus and the Grameen Bank were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. The Nobel Prize, while an exalted and well-deserved honor, is only one of nearly 100 awards that Professor Yunus has received from governments and institutions everywhere in recognition of his righteous work. What now? Well, having once confounded the global business community with the idea of lending money to the poor, Muhammad Yunus is introducing an even more revolutionary concept. In two books published in 2008 and 2010, Professor Yunus promotes the idea of social business, where corporations, rather than operating solely to realize profits for distributing to investors, instead turn their energies to solving social problems. A social business enterprise covers all costs and makes revenue while at the same time achieving a social objective, such as providing safe drinking water or creating affordable housing. The positive impact of the business on people or the environment, rather than the amount of profit made in a given period, measures the success of a social business. The idea of replacing free market capitalism with businesses that benefit all mankind and may eradicate poverty entirely is truly breathtaking, extraordinary, and it is an idea that is already at work. I speak for all of us at McGill when I say that we are truly honored and humbled to have with us today this visionary thinker whose simple goal is to change the world. Please join me in welcoming the esteemed Nobel laureate, banker to the poor, and great hope to millions in need, Professor Muhammad Yunus.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. It's a great honor for me, Mr. Chancellor, to be invited to speak and give the Beattie Memorial Lecture. I know you mentioned it and I have been told many times what a prestigious lecture series this is. So I feel especially privileged to be selected for this particular occasion to give this lecture. While it's a lecture series, people are usually used to the kind of lectures they expect from the person. I'll be a little different than that in the way I'll be not lecturing in that sense. I'll be just telling you what I do. I hope that will not disappoint you. I was introduced by the Chancellor that I did something heretic. I like the word heretic in introducing lending money to the poor people. That I didn't do because I was worrying about it or I was doing research on it. It's not like the way people devote their time and energy in, on a particular issue and then go into action for that. In my case, it's quite different. It was a quite accidental thing. I had no idea I will ever get involved with anything to do with lending money. But I ended up doing that. Even at that time, I had no idea that it will lead to anything. Simply forces around it pushed me into the direction which became a lifelong involvement in that subject. And that circumstances in which all these things happened was because of the terrible economic situation that prevailed at that time while I was teaching in Chittagong University. This was mid-70s, and we were going through a terrible economic situation right after War of Liberation. Bangladesh became an independent country in 1971, end of 1971, with a lot of devastation, a lot of killings and bloodshed. So when I came back from the States where I was teaching, and I see a situation which is pretty terrible. And it became worse as years went by, and we ended up with a famine in 1974. And this is the time now I'm teaching at the university, teaching economics. When you teach economics with a lot of enthusiasm, lots of energy as a young teacher, and you feel totally confident about the validity of all the things you teach your students. And then you walk out of the classroom, you see massive famine all around the country. And you start questioning yourself, what good is your economics that you teach in the classroom, because it has no relevance to the world outside of the classroom. So gradually you start losing faith in what you teach. Your voice become more muffled. You lose your strength in insisting on the validity of all the things that you say to your students. And as a person, you feel very useless. Useless in the sense you are not of any use to the rest of the society in the dire emergency that prevails around you. So out of this emptiness that you feel inside of you, you try to come up with something in desperation of the circumstances. So what I did, since I had no other alternative or no other options that I could find out, I thought, why don't I just walk out of the campus and be with the people right outside the campus in the village and see if I can make myself useful as a human being to any one person in the village, even for a day. I don't claim that I have any special ability or a special quality that I may make myself useful to many people for a lot of time. So I thought one individual would be good enough for me. So that's the way I kind of formulated my ambition and start walking into that village every day, trying to see what can be done. And as I started doing that, I felt I started learning a lot of things which I never learned from the textbooks. And in a way, that university, that village started appearing like a university to me, because that's a real learning for me. And I started enjoying it. Yes, this is at least I can feel that I'm being useful to other people. As I was doing, I started noticing something which I never felt so directly before. This is the loan sharking in the village. It's such a terrible thing. Unless you come face to face with the individual situation, you cannot realize it. You can see it in a movie, you can see it in a play or in a novel, You read it all the time about the torture and inhuman behavior of loan sharks. But it doesn't really get into you until you see a real situation of a person who became a victim of a loan shark. So seeing it very at a very close quarter, I thought I should try to understand more clearly what this is it, because right now I see it in the village the way it operates. So I made a list of people who are borrowing from the loan sharks and what amount they borrowed from the loan sharks, how the loan sharks kind of established their links with these people and tried to squeeze everything out of them. When my list was complete, there were 42 names on the list, and the total money they borrowed was $27. And I couldn't believe that people have to suffer so much for such a small amount of money. So I was in a big shock that so right there in front of me, I see people have been enslaved by the loan sharks just because they need a tiny little money and they happen to lend them that money. And suddenly it came to my mind that the problem is difficult, very complicated, intricate, but the solution is so simple. I can solve it right away. I don't have to wait for any consultation or any going back to my textbooks to find out how to solve it. The idea was very simple. I thought instead of loan sharks lending this $27 to 42 people, why don't I lend this $27 to 42 people and delink the people from the loan sharks? And as I came up with that idea, I immediately acted on it. I did exactly like that. I gave the money to the people to return the money to the loan sharks so that they become free from this relationship they had built between them. And it created such a sensation in the village. I didn't expect. I thought this was just one of the many tiny things I have done. This is one more tiny thing. But this one kind of get out of proportion in terms of reaction from the people. They started looking at me as I go around the village as if I have done some miracle. So I was even kidding with me that if you can become an angel with $27, it's pretty cheap. So I thought if I do another $27, probably I'll become a super angel. So I thought, if you can make so many people happy with such a small amount of money, why shouldn't you do more of it? So I was thinking how to do more of it, because it sounded like it clicked with people's need. So that kind of pushed me in that direction. Until then, it was just one more action, that's all. And I could have forgotten that whole thing. Then I was thinking I can still give money from my pocket, but I thought I should find a way so that it becomes more institutional rather than personal. Then I thought about the bank located in the campus. I said, why don't I go to the campus, go to the bank and tell the manager, here's an opportunity for you. You can lend very small amount of money to these people and you can become a hero for them because they like it so much. And instead of going to the loan sharks, they will come to you, and bank will not miss anything. It's such a small amount of money. So I told the manager. I thought he will immediately jump at it and accept it. See, you laughed. And that shows how innocent I was about banking. I was thinking completely different way. So I was surprised that he kind of shocked when I suggested that. He said, it's impossible. How can you lend money to the poor people? He explained in details how they are not creditworthy, how it's impossible to deal with them, all kinds of things. The more he argued, the more I argued back. But it didn't make any difference to him. He just stood with his position. So I didn't give up. I started talking to his senior officials in the hierarchy of the banking system, went up to whatever level I could reach out to. Everybody tells me the same thing, it cannot be done. So it went on for months, but I didn't give up. Finally, I learned something from these discussions, and I offered myself as a guarantor. I said, what about accept me as a guarantor? I become the guarantor, I sign all your papers, and I take the risk, and you give the money. This time, they couldn't quite throw me out of their windows because I spoke their language. And they saw that this time, if they reject me, I still continue to criticize them. So one way they thought, why don't they give some money to me and it will completely flop and I'll never come back to them again because it didn't work. They're totally confident that it don't work. So they agreed. They agreed because they know that I have to pay the money and they will be safe. And since I have to pay the money, I'll never come back to them again. I was happy that they agreed. So I took the money, gave it to people, and I came up with some simple ways to how to make people, to make it easy for people to pay back. Some very simple things. And it worked. The more it worked, the more I got very excited. I wanted to do more. And I kept on adding more people every round. The more it succeeded, the more bank become reluctant because they were expecting it will fail. Now it's working. And I'm taking more money. I keep on signing. I don't care where I sign. I just keep on signing. So they got really worried because they figured out that it will fail at one time, and it will be big money involved. So they were creating a lot of problems on the way. Then I thought, in the beginning, I had no idea what this is all about. I never did any lending at all. I had no idea how the banking works. Now it works. If the bank doesn't believe in it, I became a total believer in it. So why don't I create a separate bank for this? Instead of trying to persuade this bank which doesn't believe in it. Then I started a new campaign for myself to get a new bank license to create this bank. And I also insisted that there should be new law creating this bank. So it should not be created under the existing law because I felt that if we do it under existing law, sooner or later we'll be pushed in the same direction the conventional banks do because after all, I felt that law is a kind of a mold. If you create that mold, no matter what you do, once you enter that mold, you take the shape of the law that you created. So I was looking for a new mold. And it was not easy to get a law passed for something that you want to do. But I was lucky I got it through. And finally, in 1983, we got the law and we became a bank by ourselves. We began in 1976. By 1983, we became a bank. And once we became a bank, we kept on expanding our work very easily because now we know how to do the job, and merrily we kept expanding. And today, after 34 years, we work all over Bangladesh. We have over 8.3 million borrowers, mostly women. 97% of them are women. And we lend tiny money for income-generating activities so that they can improve their income, they get their talent, their creativity used by them. And women love it because otherwise they had never any source of income. They always depended on husband's income. And by depending on only husband's income, the relationship between husband and wife remains a difficult thing because he controls everything. Now that she starts earning money, she has a different kind of status in the family than she previously had. And then we made sure right from the beginning the bank is owned by the borrowers. At that time, we were a very small organization, so owning by the borrowers was a simple thing. But we wanted to make them the owners of the bank. Today, all these 8 million plus women, they own the bank because that's the way we developed it. So in a way, we created a bank which is completely different than the conventional banks. Conventional banks concentrate on lending money to the rich. We lend money to the poorest. And in many countries, including Bangladesh, they lend out to the men. We concentrate on giving money to women. Conventional banks work always in the city center and ask their clients to come and talk to them. We reversed it. We made the principle that the people should not go to the bank. Bank should go to the people. So we go to meet all those 8.3 million borrowers at their doorstep to do the business. And we made it a way that it has to be done in a weekly cycle. So within 1 week, we meet all these 8.3 million borrowers at their doorstep in all the villages of Bangladesh. It's an amazing kind of exercise to make them do the business, get the money back, and put the money in. But it goes on. Rain, shine, flood, drought, doesn't matter. So it's a routine, it's a clockwork thing, continues. It gives a tremendous strength to this whole network of people. So if you look at Grameen Bank and conventional bank, you almost feel like we deliberately created rules which are just the opposite of the conventional rural banks. You can almost say that whenever I needed a rule, a procedure, I kind of look at the conventional bank and I learn how they do it, and all I have to do is to do it the opposite way. And so I didn't have to think anything new. So it happened exactly like that. So we continued that, and then people said, well, microcredit work, the work that we do started being described as microcredit. So the new word came into the dictionary, the microcredit. It didn't exist before. And let's say microcredit is a good idea. It works for the poor people, but only for the entrepreneurial poor people. So I said, I don't understand that. What do you mean by entrepreneurial poor? We are working with all the poor. So no, unless they have the entrepreneurial ability, they won't be able to do that. They will not succeed. They will fail. I said, look, I don't understand your idea of entrepreneurship because somehow you feel that entrepreneurship is limited to some people. To me, it's completely the other way. I feel entrepreneurship is a part of being a human being. It's already built into every single human being. Just because we don't see them as entrepreneurs is because they have never had the opportunity to unleash that capacity. Society never gave them the opportunity to bring that capacity out. So once you provide that environment, they bring their capacity out and becomes an entrepreneur. Anyway, they didn't pay much attention to what I was saying. So I thought I should demonstrate it, show it that all people have entrepreneurial ability. So what I did about 4.5 years back, I started lending money to the beggars exclusively. We always did lend money to beggars, but not focused on beggars. Among many others, beggars are also Grameen Bank borrowers. But this time we made a separate program. This is absolutely dedicated to the beggars. And what we do, we go to the beggars, talk to them, and give them an idea that as you go from house to house begging, would you like to take some merchandise with you? Some cookies, some candies, some sweets, whatever, some toys for the kids. And we make it sound very simple. We tell them, look, you are going there anyway. It's not extra work for you. They love the idea. We said, look, you give people more options. Whether to give you something, some food to eat, some money to eat, free as a charity because you are poor, which you do anyway. Now you'll say, would you like to buy something from me and show what you got? And maybe she will like it or he will like it and buy something from you. So you can do either, they can give you either some money or food or buy something from you or do both. No problem. They understood the whole issue. And they started taking. I said, we give you a loan to buy all this stuff so that you can take it and sell it and make money. And I thought there will be about 1,000 or 2,000 beggars in that program, and we'll find out whether they really have this entrepreneurial capacity to, excuse me, to see that even beggars have that capacity. It became so popular. Soon we have over 100,000 beggars in that program. I was amazed that they were coming up, and our staff enjoyed it very much. They were so happy to see a beggar taking money and getting into business. And we didn't train them or anything, just explain to them this is what you can do and find out what people like and sell it. And we made it very simple for them. We said there is no interest on your loan, so that this money will never grow, no matter how long it takes. And then we told them there is no time limit on your loan. So nobody can tell you that you became a defaulter. Isn't it? Defaulter is a bad word in banking. So nobody can blame you that you're a defaulter because you have no time limit. You can spend rest of your life not paying back. It's still as good a client as anybody else. So our staff became very happy because they don't have to worry about it. Otherwise, they worry whether somebody says, no, don't worry about it. Let's give it to her. And if you pay us back anytime, whenever you feel like, you'll take more money. You can get more money to continue and expand. Today, all these borrowers, all those beggars that join, they are on second loan, third loan, and fourth loans, meaning they're paying back without having any restriction whatsoever. More than 20,000 beggars now got out of begging completely. They became door-to-door salesperson. And my colleagues worry how long will it take for the rest of the beggars to come out of begging. I said, look, don't pressure them. They are now part-time beggars. Because they are mixing begging and selling at the same time. They even know which house is good for begging, which house is good for selling. I tell them that, look, they didn't go to the Harvard Business School. But they understood the market segmentation, how to play your game. I said, don't get too anxious about it. After all, they are trying. And begging is their core business. You don't close down your core business overnight. You have to be absolutely sure that your core business can be now given up, a new business has developed. So they are developing their sales division, and soon they will come up to it. And it's really happening that way. So I give this example because it again shows you something, the capacity of individual being. We kind of neglect people. They don't have capacity and something. We have to take care of them. Sometimes taking care becomes so obsessive that you destroy them. It's not a good idea at all. You take care to make sure they can take care of themselves, not take care for the sake of take care. That's a destruction. So I'll come back to that subject later on, but this is something that we felt very good. And one of the things that we wanted to make sure that the children of Grameen families do not remain illiterate like their parents. So we wanted to make sure 100% of the children go to school right from the beginning. And it became a tradition, a culture of Grameen Bank that all the children be in school. And our staff made sure that it is done. So it's not simply lending money, collecting it back. It's a kind of taking responsibility of the family and their children. So we saw the children in school, they are moving, and they couldn't stop at primary education. They continued to high school, and many started coming into the higher education. Then higher education became difficult because their parents cannot pay for all this higher education. So we immediately introduced education loans, and education loans take them to the higher education. So thousands and thousands of students get into higher education because Grameen Bank provides all the loans to support their maintenance, tuitions, and books, and whatever they need. Today, there are more than 52,000 students in medical schools, engineering schools, universities. So you have a completely new generation coming out of them. So we want to make a break of the traditional cycle of poverty, which continues illiteracy, lack of jobs, lack of income, and lack of health. So we want to make a break that this generation be the last generation in that cycle. A new generation which is coming out of them will be completely new people, creating a new cycle, taking them forward in a new life, in a new direction. And if you go and see them, you cannot but conclude that there is nothing wrong with these poor people that you work with. They are as good human beings as anybody else. Simply, society never gave them a chance to them. When you see an illiterate mother standing next to her daughter, who is a medical doctor, or a son who is an engineer, you cannot avoid asking you the question or thinking about this idea that her mother could have been a doctor too. But she never had the opportunity to go to even to school, forget about being a doctor. She never learned how to read and write. Is it her fault? Or is it somebody else's fault? She has the same capacity, or maybe more capacity than her mother, her daughter. Her daughter became a doctor, but she remained an illiterate person. So I kind of extend that idea by saying that poverty is not created by the poor people. Poverty is created by the system that we have built. So if you were, in order to take people out of poverty, not only you have to work with the poor people providing these opportunities, also you have to work with the system to change. Because as long as you keep the system as it is, it will keep on creating poverty. Unless you kind of close down that faucet which brings out this poverty, poverty cannot be eliminated. You eliminate one, they create two. So we have to go back to the system, how to fix that, so that nobody will be a poor person. Poverty is not in the person. Poverty is imposed on the person, externally. If it is external imposition, so we have to lock it up. Where is it coming from, so that it doesn't come from outside? And I just gave you this long story about Grameen Bank. For the simple reason, after 34 years of our work, still conventional banks have not changed. You go to them, they will say the same thing, poor and not creditworthy. Whereas the whole world is beaming with people now who take this loan called microcredit. It's not Bangladeshi phenomenon anymore. It's a global phenomenon. They pay you back much better than anybody else. Our repayment rate, despite our difficulties in Bangladesh about floods and disasters and so on, never faltered, it continued. And Bangladesh is known as a country of disasters. And when disaster happens, these are the poor people who are the front line of this disaster, lose everything. Grameen Bank didn't close down because of that. Grameen Bank flourished, Grameen Bank continued, because we kind of built it up in a way that we absorb the disaster and help people overcome the disaster. And it continues that way. It's a funny thing happened because we started, again, it's a long story, but I'll not go into it. We started a program in New York City in 2008 in Queens, called it Grameen America, because we had challenged that Grameen cannot be replicated in a situation like the United States, which is a rich country, welfare system, and so on and so forth, and people are not looking for tiny money, they are looking for big money. I said, that's what you think. If you go deep into it, you'll see completely different. They said, why didn't you show us that it can be done in a Grameen way? So we took that challenge, they provided us the money, and we started it in 2008. And we repeated exactly the same thing we do in the villages of Bangladesh. Nothing changed. We actually sent some people from Bangladesh to run the program. and they've never been to the United States in their life. They are very worried when they are coming. They said, what do we do? We don't know anything about America. I said, that's your advantage. You just do what you do in Bangladesh blindly. Don't even think that you are in America. And they did exactly that, and it worked beautifully. The funny thing was, we started in January 2008. But later half of the year, the financial crisis came. And very strange situations started revealing. Big banks, huge banks, collapsing, melting away. Whereas this tiny bank with tiny loans flourishing in the same neighborhood. And I said to one of the journalists, I said, you should have asked me now, who is creditworthy? Because 34 years back you told me that the poor people are not creditworthy. Now tell me who are creditworthy. Because it's the big, rich people who are not paying back. It's the poor people in your same neighborhood are paying back 100% with no collateral, nothing. But still, system doesn't change. And that system denies access to more than half the population of the world, probably 2/3 of the population of the world. And when that is not available, this service is not available, they have hardly taken a step to move forward. When the big banks started collapsing, government has to come forward to bail them out because their argument is they are too big to fail. Meaning that if they fail, the privileged people will lose all this opportunity to continue with their life. It will create financial crisis and economic crisis. But for 2/3 of the world people, banks do not exist. Not the question of collapsing. They do not exist. We don't worry about it. We leave them to payday loan people. They can go to the payday loan, pay 500% interest, 1,000% interest, 1,500% interest. Who cares? And that becomes a $1 trillion industry. We don't worry about it. Pawn shops flourishes everywhere. We don't care about it. So that is where the system goes wrong. You don't apply your talent, your creativity to create a system we can embrace everybody. Everybody has to get into the system. Then I talk about the concept of business itself. I said the whole concept of business is also grossly mistaken because economists misinterpreted human beings. Economists imagined all human beings are just money-making machines, nothing else. All they do in their lifetime make money. And that's the goal of their life. That doesn't sound like a human condition, a human desire. It's artificially created by the theory that we built. So we are trying to fit into the theory rather than theory fitting into us. Because human being is much bigger than just being money-making machine. We are not robots. We have many more dimensions than this simple, selfish dimensions which we are given recognition for within economics. I said we are selfish, but at the same time we are selfless too. These both things coexist in all of us. So there are no two kinds of people. One is selfish kind of people and the selfless kind of people. The same people have exactly the same thing in us as anybody else. But the economists do not want to recognize that selfless part. They almost tell us that if you want to be selfless, walk outside of economics. Become a philanthropist. Give away your money if you want to be so charitable. Help other people. I said, why should I? Why should we call economics a social science if that cannot accommodate me as a whole? Takes only a piece of me and builds a whole theory that say you do it this way. I said, that doesn't make sense. And all the trouble, all the problems that we created around us came from that misinterpretation. if I kept saying this financial crisis along with all the crises we have, the crisis, environmental crisis and the energy crisis and all the social crises, is all a manifestation of a fundamental flaw in the framework of theory that we practice. Unless we eliminate that flaw, we'll keep on bumping into this problem and the crisis will become bigger and bigger. So I started creating some businesses on my own, not because I was thinking that way. On my own, I was creating many businesses, which now looks like based on that selflessness that I was talking about. Then people kept me asking that question. Then I realized, yeah, this is the different kind of business. Over time, I created over 40 such companies. In none of these companies, I own any share. I don't have a shareholder. I created them. They become large companies. But I don't want a share. Because every time I see a problem, I create a business to solve that problem. And as there are many problems, I created many businesses. One I created became quite big. Many of them became quite big. One I just particularly mentioned is called Grameen Shakti or Grameen Energy. We sell solar home system because Bangladesh doesn't have much electricity. 70% of the people have no access to electricity. So we thought this is an opportunity to bring solar energy before the fossil fuel electricity come in. So we started that. It was an expensive thing. People said it cannot be done in the villages of Bangladesh. Too expensive for them. But we came out with a business model which will be attractive for them. Instead of paying upfront, we said you can pay in a monthly installment over 2 years, over 3 years, so that it becomes easy for you. So we started selling it. We started selling 5 solar home system a month, 10 solar home system a month. We wanted to get to the 100 solar home system a month. Now we came to a stage where we sell more than 1,000 solar home system per day. So it's a huge, big thing. And we need so much solar panels from countries like Japan and Germany and China. We keep buying them because people are asking for more and more solar home system. So now we decided to set up a whole factory to produce solar panel itself so that we can make it cheaper as a social business. So all these businesses relate to that kind of business that I'm talking about, not for making money, but for solving problem. And it's based on that selflessness part of us, all of us. So I call it social business, and I gave you an example of that. And it's much better than charity. I could have given this solar home system as a free system, and I have to go to the donor. Every time I give a solar home system, I need $300 somebody to donate me so that I can give a solar home system free. So how many solar home systems could I have given? 5, 10, 100, 2,000? That's all. Donors say, okay, you stop it. I can't give you more money for free distribution of solar home system. Because in charity, money goes, it doesn't come back. So you are limited by the amount people you can raise funds. Fundraising is a very torturous work, you know that. In many organizations who are engaged in charity work, they do wonderful work. They are very dedicated people. Their frustration is their whole organization devote 80% of their time fundraising and only 20% of their time in doing the actual job because sometimes it gets more difficult to get this money. Donors become reluctant. They ask 101 questions. I said, this is important. Charity is important. But if you can convert some of this charity work into a business format, then it runs by itself. It creates its own fuel all the time and continues. And that is the solar energy thing that we are talking about. Here, I don't have to worry about money because people are paying. The more money gets paid back, I buy more and sell more. And people improve. In the meantime, I try to reduce the cost so that I can sell it to more people who didn't afford before. So that is the beauty of social business, that you can keep it as a way that it keeps running. In charity, money doesn't come back. But in social business, money recycles all the time. You created a machine which runs by itself. You don't have to bring fuel from outside anymore. So this is what I've been talking about. And I created a lot of these social businesses. One of them was with a big multinational company, Danone. We created Grameen Danone Social Business Company to produce yogurt. This is to address the problem of malnutrition among the children. We put all the macronutrients which are missing in the children into this yogurt. Vitamin, iron, zinc, iodine, and everything. And sell it very cheap so that poor people, their children can afford it. When the children eat this yogurt, they gradually get back that their nutrition and become a healthy child. And today is a very successful company in Bangladesh. We are expanding our business. So since it's a social business, expanding business is not difficult. What do? We go to the bank, borrow money, invest it, or find new investors, or same investors, put the money, invest, and continue. And we created other companies, like a joint venture with BASF. BASF is a chemical company, a German company. What we did, a Grameen BASF company, to produce mosquito net, treated mosquito net, so that people can sleep under the mosquito and the mosquitoes cannot bite them, protect themselves from malaria. Bangladesh is a malaria country. At least some part of it. And the dengue fever. So make it very cheap. In the social business, you don't want to make money. All you want to do is to stop malaria. That's all. So you're devoted to the cause. And you continue. We have another one with social business, big company social business, is a joint venture with Adidas. I challenged the company CEO that as a shoe company, it's their responsibility to produce shoes affordable to even to the poorest person. And their goal should be nobody in the world should go without shoes. Nobody should be barefoot. They took that challenge, made a joint venture with us, Grameen Adidas. And they asked me how cheap the shoes should be in order to be affordable to the poorest people. I said, maybe under €1. They were shocked. How can you produce Adidas or Reebok shoes under €1? But they didn't give up. They worked and worked and finally found a formula to produce it. It's a good, attractive looking shoes under €1 so that everybody in Bangladesh can afford shoes, every child, every woman, every man. Because people suffer from many diseases, parasitic diseases, because you go barefoot. So if you afford shoes, you protect yourself from all those hookworms and all the parasites in your body. So this is a health intervention itself. Just for €1, you get decent shoes, very durable shoes, and so on. So we had lots of these companies. I'll not go on listing them. But this is an idea that it can solve any problem. People ask me, can we design social businesses for any kind of problem? I said, of course, any social problem. You can. It's a question of creativity, how you put your mind. The moment you put your mind into it, you'll come up with some solution. But today we don't put our mind. And we are very privileged in the world that we have the most powerful technology to change the world today. We kind of hold in our hand the powerful technology the world have never seen before. And it happens every day. Every day it's become more powerful. Imagine what different things happened in the last 10 years in our life. When I was a student, Xerox machine was the biggest thing. So Xerox, you have to copy it. Probably you have not seen that unless you are of my age. Then when the fax machine came, it is the miracle of the miracle. Bangladesh government immediately issued that you have to get a government license to buy a fax machine. It's so important. And that fax machine today, in every home, with every computer, every telephone. So, mobile phone was such a miracle. In 1995, there was only 500,000 telephones in Bangladesh, landline phones. We created a phone company called Grameen Phone, mobile phone company, to bring phone in the hands of the poor people. Everybody shocked. How can poor people have telephone? What are they going to do with it? Even the regulators who will be issuing license to us when we applied for license to create this company, they asked us, you want to give this phone to the poor women? I said, yes. Who is she going to call? I said, no, she's not going to call, but people will call using her phone. This will be her business. She will be selling the airtime to the people in the village and make money. I said, it's impossible. This woman is an illiterate woman. She doesn't know how the numbers are read. I said, you misunderstand them. There are only 10 numbers in the world. If pushing them, these 10 numbers bring money, she would learn it in 10 minutes. When I first gave them, and I got the license and started this Grameen phone, and with enthusiasm, we expanded our network to the village first, before the city, to bring phone in the hands of the poor women. Grameen Bank gave her a loan. She picked up a phone. She started selling the phone service because phone service doesn't exist in the village. So she has the only phone. Everybody has to line up in front of her house to make a phone call. And she was enjoying that. So after 6 months, I went around, meet all these women who took the phone for the first time to see if they have understood how to run this business. They were bubbling with enthusiasm. So I asked someone, I said, do you have any difficulty in dialing these numbers? I remembered what I had to go through. She said, no problem. I know everything. I said, do you want me to call somebody? Give me your number. I'll call you. I said, no, it's okay. You know that. Another woman stood up. She said, you didn't give her a number. You gave the number to me. And I'll dial it. And before I dial it, blindfold me. If I cannot dial it blindfolded, take my phone back. I'm not worth it. I was stunned. I cannot believe this illiterate woman challenging me, saying, blindfold me. And if I cannot dial it blindfolded, I'll return your telephone. I wish that bureaucrat who was sitting on that regulatory agency was there. How easy to underestimate the capacity of people just because you are somewhere else. So people have that capacity. Simply, we are not unleashing that capacity. So social business is a way to expand that. It could be addressed to any kind of this. Technology makes us powerful. We can do that. We can create enormous varieties of social businesses. Taking people out of welfare could be a wonderful social business. Putting people in welfare is a very important thing. But keeping them is totally unacceptable. They are there, but we must make efforts so that they become full citizens of the country rather than depend on charity of the government, on charity of the other taxpayers. And I was exposed to this situation very drastically in Glasgow while I was speaking there. And I was told that there are thousands of families in Glasgow who are in fourth generation unemployment. I couldn't believe that in a civilized society you can have fourth generation unemployment, because you are condemning those people into a situation where they lost all their human capacity. I said that the responsibility of any society is to make sure every human being, every citizen has the capacity to unleash the energy, unleash the creativity they have. Every human being is packed with unlimited capacity. To ask them not to use that capacity is criminal. So I said, why don't we create some social business to take these people out of that prison that you created for them? And I'm sure in welfare system, this problem is not unknown. But I'm saying welfare is only part one of the solution to help people to overcome their problem. But the part two is the most important part, to get them out of welfare situation. So this has to be done. So we continued that. We created a nursing college in Bangladesh because we saw the need for nurses in Bangladesh and outside is too tremendous. I said, young girls are sitting around in the villages, getting married, having children, nothing else to do. Why don't we pick up these girls, put in a nursing college, a decent nursing college, give them world-class nursing education. So they become important citizens of the world, deliver health services. So we take the students, girls from the Grameen families, they are the poorest families, who went to school because of Grameen Bank. Now we take them to the nursing college. Grameen Bank gives the education loan to them. They pay the tuition for the nursing college. So the nursing college covers all its cost and give them the world-class education. And they find jobs in Bangladesh, elsewhere, and get become part of this whole healthcare system. And here, as was discussed yesterday, signed an agreement with McGill University. I'm very grateful to McGill University to have a collaboration between Grameen and McGill University. One of the things that will be going through this agreement, that will be creating a Grameen McGill Nursing College in Bangladesh. And we'll have such much. We can create those nurses out of these girls who can compete with anybody anywhere. But the capacity-wise, they have lacked nothing. Simply, facilities are not given. So we're creating this facility, and that's where we join hands together, because McGill University has that capacity, world-class capacity. The whole world knows about McGill University and their healthcare system and their nursing colleges. So we want to bring that knowledge to them so that they become part of this whole high-class education, and they will be different people. There's nothing wrong in them. Simply, they didn't have the opportunity. So we can create many of these opportunities around, and every single individual can do that. It's not Danone, it's not BSF, it's not Adidas who can do that. Every single individual can create a small social business to help 5 persons. That's what my beginning was, to help those people with it for $27. And that's what changed everything that I do and create this whole idea. So anybody just want to solve this particular specific problem can do in a social business way. Not to create a business to make money for themselves. They can earn money for other businesses. At the same time, they can do this social business. And it's a question of creative ideas to come. If we bring social businesses, creative ideas, technologies, nobody should remain a poor person. And there's no reason to be, because it's not part of a human being. So we look forward to a day very soon when we could put poverty in the museum, take out from the society. There'll be nobody in the world who will be a poor person. If you want to see a poor person, you'll have to go to the museum to see them. Thank you very much.
So deserving, so deserving. Professor Yunus, as president of the Alumni Association, I have the great honor to thank you for your incredible, thought-provoking presentation. But as you said at the beginning, it wasn't really a presentation. It was just telling the story of what you do. Having the power to invoke change is phenomenal. And understanding people as you do is an inspiration to us all. You've compelled us to reconsider what social business can accomplish. Indeed, the notion of applying a proven business model to social problems might at one time have seemed far-fetched. Giving society a chance, changing the old cycle of poverty, creating a business to solve problems. But, of course, the same was said of the microcredit concept and the success of the Grameen Bank. proved its worth to even the most skeptical among us. So thank you again, Professor Eunice. I wish we had more time with you today, but we'll now introduce Carl Moore, who's going to come up. You'll have a chance for a question-answer period, which I'm sure you're looking forward to. So Carl Moore is joining us on the stage here. He's going to be the moderator for this morning's question period. Professor Moore is fairly remarkable himself, actually. He holds joint appointments in McGill's Des Hôtels Faculty of Management and the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery. He is the author of dozens of journal articles and several books, and he has written widely on leadership and business strategy. Before joining the Academy, he worked for 12 years in sales and marketing positions for such high-tech industry titans as IBM, Bull, and Hitachi. These days, he lends his considerable business expertise to firms like Nokia, Morgan Stanley, HP, and Pfizer, just to name a few, for whom he is a consultant. He also contributes a weekly video cast in his spare time to the Globe and Mail. I'm nearly finished. Come on back up, please. It's more, which you can see on the McGill website, interviewing high-profile CEOs and business professors. So please join me in welcoming Professor Carl Moore.
Sorry.
One of my duties I have forgotten, and that's to present Professor Eunice with a gift from all of us.
Thank you, Cynthia. And unfortunately, no time for questions because of the lengthy introduction of myself. So, seriously, there's two microphones here, so if you could come down and approach the mics, it'd be delightful to hear questions from the audience and follow up on the wonderful lecture. So perhaps we'll start at the front here.
Hi. Professor Eunice, banks are getting more and more interested in microcredit. We've been reading for the last year about a lot of businesses they want to do in microcredit. How do you see it? Does that get you worried, and where will that lead us if banks get into microcredit?
Well, I was always inviting banks to join into the microcredit, so I cannot say that they're doing bad things. But the only thing I warn that microcredit always has to be seen from the social point of view, so near about the social business. We try to run microcredit in the social business level. So it's not the profit-making motive which brings you to the microcredit. Some banks are doing that. They want to make money out of the microcredit. So it's not a kind of service you want to provide to the poor people to help them get out of poverty, but rather to make money. And we have very extreme cases in that where they want to make enormous amount of money. And they have done that already, and we have been very critical of that. We tell them that this is something we don't deserve to be called microcredit. Microcredit is about helping people in a business way, not as an opportunity to make money out of the poor people. If we call those banks who make enormous amount of money by doing microcredit, then we have to call payday lenders also microcredit, because they lend money to the poor people, but then charge 1,500% interest. So there should be a line drawn up to where you can go, and from that red line, if you cross, then you are no longer microcredit. You can call yourself anything you want, but please don't use the word microcredit and confuse people.
Thank you very much.
Professor Eunice, I have two questions about men in Bangladesh. If men have quite a bit of power, to what extent are the women still under men's control, even though they may receive microcredit or participate in social business? And the second question is, men in Bangladesh must have quite a few problems with unemployment and lack of business and lack of education, to what extent can microlending and social business help the men with those problems?
Yeah. The number one, we do lend money to men. We do not deny money. So women becomes a representative of the family. She deals with the bank. She owns the bank. But the facilities of the bank are available to all the members of the family, so husband included. She borrows money for her husband's business. Lots of them do big investments in like buying equipments, buying vehicles, who are traditionally, for example, one common thing for men, those who are drivers, who has worked as a driver, as a micro, as a minibus driver, truck driver, or even a baby taxi or a three-wheeler driver. So the first, their first thing is, I've been a driver for the last 15 years. Can the bank give me a loan to buy myself a microbus or buy myself a mini truck or a full bus? And bank willingly does that. So there's no problem. But it is through the woman. That's the only thing we make a requirement. So there's not a denial to that. And about the men and unemployment, education, when we give loans, we give all loans to both men and women among the children. So they are all coming to higher education. And our regret is only the boys go to the higher education. Very few coming girls coming to the higher education. That's why we're trying to build all these nursing colleges and other, which are specialized for girls, because girls kind of stopped by their families when they go into higher education. Very few compared to male students who go into it. And then we are encouraging to become entrepreneurs. We say, we make them take a pledge that we are not job seekers. We are job givers. So right from the education type, they will be always thinking that my responsibility is to create jobs. So that they do not think in terms of where am I going to get a job, because they have money behind them to the Grameen Bank. So there's no discrimination in that sense. We feel unhappy about something, which, as I said, women are not coming, girls are not coming forward, and we are encouraging them to come forward. But definitely it's open to all of them.
Hello, Dr. Yunus. You've faced in your career several challenges, and you've overcome them quite inspirationally. What I'd be interested in knowing is, what is the most difficult lesson you had to learn, and how did that impact your career and your life in general?
The one most difficult part, probably, I would say, is the mindset of people. Because people go through a certain preparation in their life, in their student life, or in their business life, and they formulate their mind what this world about and what they would do, what institutions can do. Well, for example, I had difficulty, tremendous amount of difficulty with the bankers. They cannot believe that you can lend money to the poor people, number one. They cannot believe that you can lend money without collateral. They got shocked. How can you do that? Even with collateral, we have so much difficulty getting our money back. You just give it to them? Not ask for anything? Are you sure they will pay you back? I said, they do it every day. Do you have a good sleep at night? Give. Because in Grameen Bank, we lend out over $100 million a month. It's a lot of money to lend out. And we don't feel threatened that, oh, this, what happens if it doesn't, if this money doesn't come back? That question never enters our mind. And that's the only question that enters the mind of a banker, that, oh, something is going on. So mindset, and now I'm talking about social business. People find it very difficult. How could you run a business without making money? What kind of business is that? Because we always train to think in terms of money-making business. I said, all of us are fitted with money-making glasses as we go along in our school, in our colleges. They're all training you how to make money. So we cannot think, we cannot see something without making money. So I said, why don't you take off your glasses? You see the world as it is. And perhaps you can put on the social business glasses. Then the whole world will look so different, so exciting. I can change the world. It's within my capacity. And a fantastic capacity that I feel inside of me, I can make an impact in people's life. And I'll enjoy that. It's not somebody pushing me to do that, because I enjoy it. Making money is an enjoyment. Changing life of other people is much more enjoyment than making money. Once you do that, then you'll realize which happiness you want to do more. Both happiness is at your disposal. It's a choice that you have to make. Thank you.
Professor Yunus, Despite the enormous success of your ideas, Bangladesh remains one of the poorest countries in the world. Why aren't the politicians and the businessmen of Bangladesh following up on your great success?
Well, one, just a quick explanation is a previous question. Mindset takes time. Another one, Bangladesh doing pretty good. I mean, there are a lot of poor people. Bangladesh is a big country in terms of number of people. We are 160 million people. But Bangladesh is one of the lucky countries today who will be achieving all the 8 Millennium Development Goals by 2015. So it's not a tiny piece of news. It's a big news for celebration. We are on the way, and we're very much on track to reduce poverty by half by 2015. So it's a big news because Bangladesh started as the poorest country in the world. So to reduce that poverty by half is a great, great achievement, accomplishment for Bangladesh. And we are on the way. We just had the Millennium Summit in the United Nations. And Bangladesh was celebrated as one of those lucky countries, fortunate countries, who will be achieving all the 8 Millennium Development Goals. We are slightly behind in 2 goals on maternal deaths and others. But we can catch up in the next 5 years. That's an attempt that we are making, how to save our health care as a social business and so on, putting all our energy together to achieve that. So that, I would say, is something. And in Bangladesh, we are in the discussion. Follow-up of the 2015. After 2015, what would be our goal? We are saying we want to bring poverty to zero by 2030 so that Bangladesh can become one country where there will be nobody, there will be a poor person in Bangladesh. So that is the kind of goal that you set, you work for it, and make it happen. And all these things together can make it happen. We'll be very close to achieving that, if not in 2030, maybe 2031, so that we can make it zero poverty. So we are poor, but we are in the right direction, and our economy is growing pretty good, 6%, 7%, even during the financial crisis. So that way it's not bad either. As I said, it's a disaster-prone country. It's a land of disaster. Despite all those disasters, despite all our problems, the progresses are very significant. Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Yunus. One thing struck my curiosity, got me curious. Did you receive any resistance from people wanting to use microcredit?
No, not resistant because of microcredit as such. People have hesitation, difficulty in accepting microcredit because first resistance came because we gave loan to women. Men didn't like it. Very natural reaction. Because traditionally, men in the family, the husband felt threatened because I'm giving loan to his wife. So he feels that his authority is being undercut. So he opposed it. And he also felt that his wife has no experience of any handling money. She will make a disaster, and he has to pay it back now. We had to assure 1,000 times that we'll never come to you if she fails. It's between us and her. We'll work it out together. But you don't have to worry about being compelled to pay back her loan. So this is another one. Another reason we were opposed, religious people interpreted that it is against religion because we are giving money to women. Actually, it's a male issue. It's clothes in a religious way, the giving money to women. So we had a big kind of confrontation with the religious people. But luckily, we could argue with, well, it worked. We said, look, the Prophet of Islam, he married a businesswoman. Not only he married a businesswoman, first he worked under her. She took a job. She took a job under her. Later, he married her. I said, if you want to be a good Muslim, you have to follow the footsteps of the great prophet. And you have to marry a businesswoman. And if you can't find one, come to us. We have plenty of them.
Dr. Yunus, I'm from Congo, DRC, which is a post-conflict zone.
And I would like to know if you know about an initiative which would be able to help the women there, because they're excluded, you know, because of rape, poverty. So we're really looking to have a way, you know, finding a program that would work in post-conflict zone like Congo, DRC, for women.
Yeah. In Africa, there are lots of microcredit programs, including Congo. We just had a microcredit summit in Nairobi this year, at the beginning of this year. So all those microcredit around Africa came to Nairobi to discuss their problems. But there are small programs. Definitely needs much robust programs. In Congo, it's a conflict zone, and Bangladesh is very much present through the peacekeeping force in Bangladesh, in Congo, as we are familiar with some of the circumstances. But we'll be delighted to be of any help in any way to do that. We work in Zambia. Zambia has a Grameen program run by us, and it works beautifully. We're doing it for the last 6 years, and we do that. So gradually, hopefully, we can come around. And
so how can we get in touch with you?
I'll let you know. I'll give you my card and get in touch.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Dr. Yunus. I'm an international student from Indonesia, which is also a developing country like Bangladesh. And we have 15 to 20% of the population amount to 20 million people living under the poverty line. And what I found out is that some of the people coming from poor families, they have this kind of mentality, a fixed mindset, full of acceptance of their current condition, making a living by begging at the sidewalk or like at the traffic light, or to the extreme, they do crime to make their living to survive. So I believe, like you said, entrepreneurship is part of us as a human being. But how can we as a part of society make a change in their mentality so that they make them aware of the opportunities and their capabilities as a human being? Thank you.
In the way I do it, I have stopped worrying about others' mentality. I try to change my mentality first, to do things in a way others don't think about that. So I do it. I don't feel ashamed of it or embarrassed because I'm doing something, because I see that it's an opportunity to do that. If you create a system, it changes the thinking process also. Like the women that I just mentioned, that we have 8.3 million borrowers, 97% of them are women, they were not the one that, okay, give me the money, I'm going to go to business. Jumping, no. They said, no, don't give the money to me. I don't know what to do with money. I'm afraid of money. Give the money to my husband. He's the one who handles money. That's our beginning point. But we didn't take that as a kind of her final answer. We said, this is a, when she speaks, she's speaking, her history is speaking. She's not speaking. The way she was built, the way society has kind of squeezed her with all the worries, all the fears in life. So she's talking through the layers and layers of veil of fear. So she cannot speak out. So I said, we have to remove those layers and layers of fear so that she can speak out and feel that I can do it. And it's the beginning. The beginning is always very small, always with one, always with two. If you can make two work differently, it will impact on 10. And the 10 are working, it will change 100. So we have to make a beginning. All those people that you said, we can create social business to get help. I'm just giving the beggar story. Beggars are not the one, okay, I'll be business people. Suddenly it's just a little money. How much a loan is asked for by a beggar when she goes into a business? Biggest amount she can think of is something like $15. And that's the biggest amount she could handle. And we give her a $15 loan. And she starts her business buying little things and carrying around and selling it. And they got excited. Now she is the one who's selling Danone yogurt. Soon she will be selling this Adidas shoes, Reebok shoes. Because she knows how to sell things. So I said, okay, this is a business for you too. So this becomes an income for her. Or BSF mosquito nets. She said, I'll sell mosquito nets if anybody is interested. So as I go from house to house, here is a mosquito net. Would you be interested? And she will have a spiel how to explain this mosquito net. That's it. So it's all possible. It's a question of how we design things, how we bring our creativity. We can work together and build some social business. Try it out. It's fun. And we always say social business should be done with joy. So it's really fun to do that. Thank you.
I'm afraid in the interest of time, I'll just have two more questions.
We're
going a bit late, and that's wonderful, because I think all of us are quite engaged. It's Saturday morning. There's not anywhere else to be anyway. So let's enjoy that, but we'll have to end it at a certain time because it's more homecoming activities. We'll have time for two more questions.
Sure. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Yunus. It is an honor to be in your presence, especially after having been in Chittagong when you won that award.
Thank you.
I was working for Young Power and Social Action, an NGO I'm sure you're familiar with. My question is, where does Grameen Bank get its capital from, especially pertaining to the educational funds?
Yeah. Well, the whole Grameen Bank is run with its own money. It doesn't come from outside. We don't take any money from the government or international agency or another bank or borrow or get a grant, nothing. We entire money comes from our own system. It's a bank. We take deposits. We lend the money to the people who need it, the poor people. So we have more money than we need. Sometimes it becomes quite a problem for us. Where do we invest our money? How to expand ourselves to get this money out so that people can use this money? So that's a happy situation. That's why I said there should be separate law for microcredits so that you can create a bank, microcredit bank. So don't have to worry about money coming from outside. Mm-hmm. And for microcredit, I always said for microcredit, money should not come from outside to begin with, and even for the NGOs. There should be local money because this is not, you don't need any hard money to do business in the international arena. All you need is local money. So there should be local provisions of that money if you're an NGO. But if you're a bank, you have plenty of money yourself. So education loan comes from our own money. Loan for the beggars comes from our own money. All the loans, the $100 million plus that we give out every month comes from our own money. And that money keeps growing and we keep on expanding that business as we go along. Each branch, it's not only Grameen Bank as a whole, each branch is self-sufficient with its own money. A branch doesn't borrow money from the next branch. It's all their own money which lends out and become profitable and give this profit. As the bank makes profit, profit goes back to the borrowers because they are the shareholders. They get the dividend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Professor Yunus. I am working in social entrepreneurship and trying hard to make understand my colleagues in my school that this is a good way to go for work. And you were saying that mindset is a problem. And for me, it's a big problem, the mindset with money. Because, for instance, when I get into social entrepreneurship, my parents was, what? You want to make money? My friends, well, social business. Danone wants to make money with the poor. And so there are social entrepreneurs that have difficulties to understand how I can make money with social, and big companies who wants to help that people are telling them don't make money with poor. How do you explain to people that there is no crash between the two things?
It's a question of explaining what the concept of social business, how it is done, what is the purpose. Since it's a new concept, still many people are not aware of it because it's not part of the textbooks. When it becomes a part of the textbooks, then everybody will learn there are two kinds of business in the world, one to make money, another to change the world. So you know how you change the world, how you make money for yourself. You can be bought. You can make money in a money-making business, use the money in social business to change the world. So you design it, or you start designing social business yourself. Because to design social business, you don't have to go to a consulting firm to design me a social business. You can do it yourself. Your creativity is the one which is the most important thing in social business. And then along the way, we are also urging people to come up with funds, create social business funds. Many of these social business funds has already been created. I hope soon Montreal will have its own social business fund, or Canada will have its own social business fund. People will put together money to be invested. You have a great idea, and this money will be invested in your great idea so that that idea could be implemented. We have this social business fund already created, and I have been talking about Haiti for a long time since the whole earthquake has begun. I said much of this money will be wasted in Haiti because Haiti doesn't have a structure to use this money because everybody wanted to help Haiti and pour in lots of money, lots of resources. I said, why don't you use part of this money, say 10% of this money, put this into a social business fund. so that others can create social businesses to create employment, create transportations, create housing, environmental programs, all kinds of things as a social business, nursing colleges or garment industry as a social business, so that people have jobs, people have things to do, not for making money, but for creating those permanent sustainable institutions. So now we have created that social business fund for Haiti, and I'm very happy Inter-American Bank, the bank for Latin America, development bank for Latin America, they came forward to create a social business fund in collaboration with us. So they will be putting a lot of money in that social business fund. I was told about $60 million in that social business fund for Haiti. So if you have a great idea for Haiti, come and contact us. We have the money ready for you.
With pleasure.
Yes, please. Anybody who has the great idea for Haiti, contact us. We'll make sure you get the funding, investment from the social business fund that we created. We'll be involved in that fund. So that way we know. We want to create absolutely new way in Haiti so that young people get involved and create a completely new kind of country for themselves, have a beautiful green coverage. Today, Haiti has only 2% forest coverage in the country. So we said we will change the whole thing as a social business. We can run this social business to create forests, create mango orchards, delicious foods, and all kinds of things can happen in Haiti. And that's what we're looking forward. All we need is technology. All we need is a great business idea how to solve it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Before we finish this morning, I'd like just to recognize and thank a few people that went into putting together this great event this morning. First, to the BD Memorial Lecture Committee, chaired by Rima Rosa, who's our Interim Vice Principal of Research and International Relations, for their sponsorship and organization of the event. Secondly, the World Platform, Professor Laurette Dubay, for Health and Economic Convergence, the faculty management, for bringing Dr. Eunice to McGill. There's a memorandum of understanding being signed between McGill, Faculties of Management, Medicine, Dr. Eunice's organization, which hopefully will help bring social business here to Montreal, Quebec, and Canada. The Homecoming Committee for their involvement in the organization, the Major Beattie Memorial Lecture. And finally, Dr. Eunice, of course. You know, it's when you think about Dr. Eunice, very clearly a man that is very bright, a fine mind, a PhD from Vanderbilt, but I think more a man with a great heart. As you think of the concern and the love, that's what moves you to think about what can we learn from Dr. Eunice today. That he has a great heart, he has a positive view of human nature. Perhaps occasionally naive, but optimistic. And 100 million people got help, so maybe not that naive after all. And it's something when we think about that, this is a great university at its best perhaps. The power of ideas, microcredit, social business, and the power of a courageous individual. But often you run into great people to hear from, like Dr. Eunice. What struck me is that I can be a bit like him. I'm not sure I can be like President Obama or people like that of enormous stature. But the amazing thing, here's one of the world's great people, and I think you got that message as well, that I can learn from him and be a bit better person. And I particularly encourage my younger students, see some of them sitting here in the audience, to reflect this weekend. Put away the books. I'm not teaching, so I can say that this semester. For an hour or so, put away the books and look up into space and just think about, how will I make the world a bit better place? We've heard from someone who's done it. Let's you and I go out and do that. Thank you, Dr. Eunice.
Thank you.